All right, welcome back. So, talking about the worldly wins. And I think we all, if we're honest, we definitely prefer when life gives us pleasure, when it gives us praise, when life gives us fame, or also gain. So much of our lives are really oriented around those positive things, how to get more of those. And the same thing, we prefer not to have loss. We prefer not to have pain or disgrace or blame. And so much of our life is trying to avoid those. And yet the Buddha pointed toward, to some degree, no matter what we do, these winds will blow. And they'll blow different ways. Sometimes we'll experience gain, sometimes loss, sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain. And pointing that out, he said, it doesn't matter if you are a well-taught person, someone who's practiced deeply and has deep understanding, or if you just walked what he called a run-of-the-mill person, someone who's just never practiced and is chasing after these winds. Both of these winds blow one way or the other. And then how do we learn to meet those? How can we meet those with skill, with a quality of understanding, with wisdom? Or can we meet them in a way that creates more suffering? Kind of the essential question that he brings up in this particular sutta, the failings of the world. So these eight conditions of gain, loss, status, disgrace, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. And again, someone like the Buddha will experience these, and someone who's never practiced will also experience the same winds. But how we relate to them, how we meet those, does tremendously change. In this sutta, if you had a chance to read it, he talks about the difference between these two types of people, but he doesn't really give a lot of instructions of how do you move from one camp into the other? How do you start to transform your own heart and mind? And so the way I often like to use these in my own life is to see when those winds blow, is how do I meet them? With a sense of stepping back and being curious. Oh, I really am feeling that loss in a very profound way. I'm really feeling that criticism in a strong way. Or I'm really leaning into trying to get more praise or get more fame, more pleasure, more gain. To step back, that's the stepping back that is so much of our practice as meditators. Instead of being enmeshed and lost in our reactivity, lost in what's happening, as the Buddha talks about these eight worldly winds, the worldly conditions that spin after the world and the world spins after them. This is how we often get lost in them. We're chasing after the pleasure and the pain, the pleasure and the gain, avoiding the pain and the loss. This is the chasing after the world. So as meditators, we have this simple instruction of meeting whatever is present with as much clarity of mind and stillness of mind, but also a non-reactiveness and even a friendliness of attention. This is the art of mindfulness, the art of learning to perceive what is here. And so it often does feel like a little bit of a stepping back at first because we're so used to being enmeshed in that world. Eventually, it actually transforms to us feeling even closer to life, but we're not closer to our reactivity, not closer to are chasing after these and avoiding the other ones. So this sutta, the Buddha kind of goes through these different categories that when gain arises, again, all these positive ones, all the painful ones, the first thing is to notice, okay, are these permanent? Are they subject to change? Are they inconsistent? Are they stressful? And that first piece is that discernment of how things actually are. That discernment of how things actually are. Now, if we're well taught, we're so much of our training is to learn how to perceive things, how they actually are. To see through our projections, through our, the way we create the world. This is our habits of mind. This is our past reactivity, our past experiences, our deep cultural biases, our deep conditioning that doesn't allow us to see life how it actually is, but see our projection of that life. It's the same thing with these things. These arise and we feel them so personally. We feel them so in such a gripping way. So it's discerning how they actually are. This is the first kind of distinguishing factor that the Buddha spoke of. So this is a very practical topic. Now, we all experience gain and loss, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. And next time you feel that, see if you can step back and notice, even noticing, wow, this is a painful experience. I mean, so often I'm just so busy reacting to the pain. I'm trying to get rid of the pain. But just to step back a little bit, notice, oh yeah, of course this is painful. Of course this hurts. Hurts physically, hurts mentally. That stepping back is actually paradoxically a turning toward that allows compassion to come forth. And of course, I want more gain. I want more praise or fame. A turning toward. The next part, the next section, the Buddha talks about how our mind relates to these eight winds. Okay, so the way that we do it, if we're not well taught, if we're just the run-of-the-mill person, or if we're lost, you know, also if it's not just an either-or, I think we all have these, we can feel very practiced in some areas of our life, and then, you know, the right person comes along or that right trigger, and suddenly we feel like we've never practiced before. Now, this is the reality of how things are, that we don't wake up completely all at once, usually. Usually we wake up in some areas and we have to bring our attention to bear to really integrate our practice with those more sticky points. And so this next one is, how does the mind relates to it? And his line was that the mind becomes consumed with the gain, consumed with the loss, with the status, the disgrace, the censure, the praise, the pleasure, remains consumed with the pain. Think of that sense of consumed, how we eat something, or maybe a flame is burning something. It just becomes so enmeshed, so gripped with that experience. You know, it's so often, you know, if your mind's all like me, when you feel that, when you feel blame, when you don't feel like you should be blamed, the mind just can contract around that. When you want to justify it, when you want to, you know, rebel against that, it's that that all-encompassing consumption around that state, or that sense of being praised, or that special thing that you finally have gained, and how the whole mind loses this perspective. We no longer are mindful of that experience. We're consumed by it. And if we're able to bring our practice to bear, we're able to step back a little bit and realize, oh, here's this mind state. Here's this experience. And how is my mind relating to it? So it's important not to try to pretend you're other than what you are. You need to be very deeply honest with yourself, that when that quality of being consumed arises, just to notice it, to say, okay, this is how the mind is. This is a such a beautiful paradox, because so often we think, okay, if my mind's consumed, then I'm just lost. I'm a failure as a meditator. And we've just added a whole nother level of our minds being consumed around our self-blame, our self criticism. But if we can step back and notice, oh, that's what's present, suddenly we're not lost in it. We're able to actually meet it, to see it clearly, to discern how it is, and then from that place to act skillfully in relationship to it. How do I relate to this loss? How do I relate to this gain in a way that is skillful, that adds more, maybe enhances it or helps alleviate the suffering around it? And the next line, the next section is around how we welcome. So someone who's not well taught, again, someone who's kind of the run of the mill or in a mind state isn't up to that mindfulness quality, we really welcome those arisen gains, and we rebel against their arisen losses. We welcome their arisen status and rebels against their arisen disgrace. welcoming their risen praise and rebelling against the risen censure, welcoming the pleasure and rebelling against the pain. This quality of welcoming, you know, it's that leaning into, that quality of clinging, of grasping after, of that turning toward and wanting more of. The rebelling against, that movement away. You can hear this is another way of talking about craving and aversion, like from the hindrances, and also even more fundamentally from the second noble truth of tanha, of thirst, how we thirst after something or thirst away from something, and how that becomes this launching pad for creating this sense of me, this sense of self around this. Because it's not just the fact that I want it, it's like me, I become the me who's wanting. I become the person who's wanting. I'm becoming the person who's being criticized, being blamed, the person who's experienced this loss. And this, I think this is the underlying piece that the Buddha points to so often is that quality of taking it so personally, creating that quality of self around it is where the suffering comes. That's really the distinguishing factor. Because if we're unconscious to it, if we're not paying attention, the self is just primed to come up with these. These are just ripe to create this sense of self. You know, being praised, wow, I feel so good about myself. Being blamed or criticized, suddenly I feel so bad about myself. I really know who I am in those extremes. I really know who I am when I'm proud of myself. I really know who I am when I'm ashamed of myself. So these are the four, I think there was four of them we just went through, of the mind being just not realizing what's present or seeing, okay, this is here, this is what's arisen. Noticing when the mind becomes consumed or when it's not consumed, when it's able to observe and to perceive. That sense of a welcoming and rebelling. So much of this, you know, our lives do teach us this kind of fallacy that we should only seek what's pleasurable, only seek what's praise, that brings praise, that brings gain. Because those of us who have been around a while and have observed our life, that sometimes the things we most appreciated getting in the moment, maybe on the long term turn out to be not so great, or vice versa. I think particularly with some of the things we the disappointments, the losses, sometimes those become the seeds for some very deep growth, or perhaps a shift of how we're navigating through life. I'm just, you know, thinking about perhaps choices you made in your life, those choice points of maybe where you're going to live or what kind of job you're going to do and what work or school or partner you might have. And we make those choices the best we can. And yet that opens up a whole different road of what unfolds. Like I'm sitting here today because I went to school at the University of Washington to study forestry. And I haven't worked in that field for probably 30 years. But yet that choice that led to things I cannot imagine. There's that kind of fun story of the maybe yes, maybe no, where the farmer who's, you know, has the success of having the loss of losing his horse, and then the horse comes back with a new horse, and his neighbors are praising him and saying this is so great or this is so terrible, and he steps back and says, well, maybe it is and maybe it's not, you know, it's too soon to tell. This is this, you know, this quality of just stepping back and seeing, okay, how is this going to unfold? And through all of this, we start to really understand what causes suffering in the fundamental way. And that's that quality of contraction of self, that contraction of me, the contraction of who I am and what I am. Now, sometimes this contraction around me feels painful. It's obviously painful when I lose a loved one, when I lose some aspect of my health, and I lose a cherished possession. I mean, it's very obvious that there's pain there. But it's not so obvious when I gain something, when I gain something so I'm so excited by. But it's also that quality of self that's also arising with it. So the solution isn't to be disconnected and aloof from life. So you don't feel, you know, that pleasure, you don't feel the pain, but to hold it in a different perspective. To not contract around that sense of me, around that sense of story making. Of this is who I am. This defines what I am and who I am, or defines who you are, what you are. To kind of keep a foothold really in the sense of mystery, the sense of things unfolding in a way you can't really fully understand, certainly can't understand intellectually, but you can let your heart really connect with that stillness, with that wonder of that. And so then when pain arises, okay, we can meet that with curiosity. We can meet it with skillfulness, the quality of turning toward. When pleasure arises, we can feel it. We can enjoy it, but we don't contract around holding it longer than this natural lifespan. With praise, you know, feeling that quality of, oh, someone's appreciating, you're seeing me in a certain way, but holding it lightly to realize that there will also be blame coming at some point. The same thing with blame, noticing how that, so for many of us, turns into that self-diminishment, that self-lack that we feel so at a core of us, for so many of us. This is what I am. This is who I am. To realize, okay, this is just someone expressing criticism, someone blaming. It may be more about their own perspective and experience than it is about me. Or maybe it is something to hear, to learn. Oh, let me hear that feedback and see what I can learn from that. So you start to get a sense that we're able to, when we don't get so contracted in that sense of me, we're able to have a lot more choices. The more contracted we are to the sense of self, the sense of personalization, the sense of identification around this, the less options we have. We're kind of locked into that way we always have to be, the way the options have become very narrow. We're able to feel it without becoming so identified with it. Then we can actually be much more spontaneous. We can see our pain arise. We can see our wanting arise. And we can meet it with more and more skill, more and more of a sense of understanding. So these worldly winds of gain and loss, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, pleasure and pain, the more invested we are, identified we are with these eight, the more suffering we experience. The less we are identified, the less suffering we have. The more we can really appreciate those positive ones and meet those difficult ones with more balance, with more grace. All right, so I think that's all I wanted to say for that recap. So let's just sit for a moment or two and let those words settle. All right, so as a way to help us integrate and articulate our own understanding, our own journey around these, I'd like to suggest we break up into some small groups. You know, if you'd like to pass on that, you're welcome just to sit quietly here in the room or at home, and then about 8:30 we'll come back to the large group. So, Kathy, if you could put people into groups, get the group breakout room set, and I'll explain what we're going to talk about. So we do groups of 4 to 5 people, and same thing here in the room. And so we use the homework from last week, you know, reflecting on your own experience around gain and loss, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, and pleasure and pain. And reflecting on that, how identified I am with those, you know, which extremes, you know, which ones do I really have a lot of charge around, not so much charge. And notice how that sense of you tends to form around those. You know, that sense of, okay, I really know who I am when I'm being praised, when I really know who I am, when I'm feeling disgrace. And just talk in a way that's, you know, as concrete as you can, as simple as you can, and as honestly as you can. And all these groups, again, we'll hold them, things said in there confidentially. And it's not about offering advice to each other. It's more about sharing and listening deeply. So share from your experience and let other people share from their experience. All right, looks like everyone's back from online. So we have a chance to talk about how these worldly winds blow in your life and how do you meet them, and what ways you meet them with skill and ways you meet them with more difficulty. Anyone notice any preferences, or maybe not preferences, but the ones that you find more challenging or more easy to work with? You're welcome to raise your hand. Looks like Sean and Bruce, go ahead.
Hi, Tim. Hi, everybody. I would like to learn how to be more skillful in working with pain, physical pain, in the sense of, I mean, I've been working with physical pain. It's just part of my life. So there's a lot of things I have been doing. But when you were in your talk, you were talking about welcoming these winds. And I don't welcome the physical pain. I don't fight against it as much as I used to, and I understand the impermanence of it, and then I will eventually come out the other side in not as great of pain. I'm in pain right now. But I don't welcome it. And so maybe you could say something about that. Be helpful. I'd like to do better with this, because I'm going to have it for the rest of my life. It's like, it's not going to go away. So it's the thing that I get to work with this time.
Thank you, Sean. Yeah. So I think, you know, welcoming the actual pain, that can be a big reach, you know, a difficult thing to try to get to, but perhaps we can welcome the opportunity to work with it. Maybe even the delight of learning about ourselves in relationship to that pain. And so much of physical pain is learning, you know, as the second Dart Sutta talks about how we add this unnecessary amount of struggle, suffering, and selfing around pain. You know, we create this whole story around it, and learning how to come back into just, okay, this is just the bare experience. This is the direct experience. And noticing how that's really hard to do. We so often we feel pain. I mean, we're deeply wired to move away from pain and to avoid pain, which is a good thing. But when it's something that's chronic that you can't shift, you can't get rid of, that you're just having to deal with day after day, it starts to develop this whole momentum of, you know, this is today going to be like yesterday, or is the next week going to be like last week, or the next year going to be like the last 5 years? And so suddenly, instead of meeting just the sensations, we're meeting this whole, you know, 15-year period, both forward and back in our lives. And so learning to, okay, how can I become curious around that? How can I find that place of interest around it? How can I start to separate out my story and the meaning I put to the pain to the actual experience of it? And so there's, you know, there's many ways we can talk about working with that. You know, one is to kind of reframe it from pain to sensation. Remember Ajahn Chichito was holding us in these Qigong postures for a long time. And, you know, long enough you started to feel some physical pain. And he said, instead of feeling it as pain, feel it as pressure or as warmth. Because we think of pain, suddenly we're relating to it from that, you know, that load of something to get rid of. But have that quality of curiosity of, okay, maybe if I label this not as pain, but as sensation, how would it relate to it? you know, start to notice what the story is that comes up around it, and, you know, getting to know that story so you can see where you're adding to it. And then also there's the third way I'll just suggest is that the art of titration, of balancing our mind. Because when something is painful, you know, our mind tends to really contract around it. Like our whole world becomes really rigid around this. And we're trying to struggle it, or we're distracting ourselves or avoiding it, you know, and all those qualities. And so sometimes actually taking a intentional break, saying, I want to distract myself, you know, give myself something else to focus on can be helpful. Because otherwise the mindfulness gets too tense, too rigid. Another technique is to shift to something else in the moment, which isn't painful. You know, maybe listening to a bird song, listening to something that's actually soothing and beautiful. Maybe noticing a part of the body that is actually pleasurable. And just in some ways, you're ignoring the pain for a little while to rebalance the mindfulness. And then come back to the pain for a few moments, maybe, you know, a 5-to-1 ratio, one part connecting with pain, 5 parts connecting with something that's neutral or even pleasurable. And you can go back and forth. And this is actually a really helpful technique to start to loosen up our kind of contraction, this kind of contracted relationship we have with pain. Because you start to see, okay, that you feel the pain's never changing. But by doing this, you start to see, actually, it is fluxing. It is actually flowing and moving in certain ways. And also being wise with, you know, how you take care of your body, you know, like having that reclined position to ease the pain as much as you can, to use ice, to get therapies. There's all those things are also very skillful. And it's, you know, it is rough. We would prefer not to have pain in our bodies. And I appreciate that you're willing to work with it the best you can. So hopefully something there is helpful there, Sean.
Yes, thank you. It is helpful. I think when I heard you say welcoming it, then I went into blame. Blaming myself, oh gosh, I don't know how to do that. But a lot of the things that you just suggested, I do know how to do those things. And so it just kind of validated that I'm doing okay. You know, I'm doing the best I can, and I know a lot of those tools, and I just stick with that. I'm all right. I don't need to blame myself that I don't welcome the pain in, you know, maybe someday, but not today.
I think welcoming the pain probably doesn't, you know, that may not fit so well with those coupling of phrases of welcoming the pain. It's much more of welcoming the, okay, I can, this is still an expression of life. So you're welcoming the expression of life. You're welcoming seeing how your mind is relating to it. But the pain itself, it's, you know, of course you'd rather it not be there.
Yeah. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Sean. I hope you find ease in your body.
Thank you.
All right, so let me see if there's anyone in the room, and then we'll come back to you, Ruth. Anyone in the room like to share anything? All right, Cheryl.
I had, you know, an interesting week last week, and just, you know, a lot of things going on. And this weekend, I decided to take the weekend off. And I was really kind of dealing with a lot of it. And, you know, and as usual, coming from a place of, you know, not really knowing everything, but really needing support and, you know, all this. And what I had a really hard time with was not self. I mean, it's like, okay. And I've been working with not self, you know, not taking things personally for quite a while, you know, for the last year, pretty strongly, I think. And I thought I understood it, but then I, you know, it's like, well, of course this is about me. Who else is it about? And then I'm like, you know, and then I'm taking that and I'm like, well, everybody is concretizing me. And so I'm seeing everybody, you know, this whole crowd of people who are, you know, blaming or whatever, you know, and concretizing me. And I'm doing the same thing to myself, But it's very confusing because I think, well, you know, if there's no self there, then who's being respected or disrespected? And does respect or disrespect even play in this, you know, and what's really going on here? And so I don't know if you can speak to that. I'd love to hear.
Sure. Are you able to hear her online? Okay. Great. Yeah. So, you know, talking about that, you know, taking things personally and that sense of self and how, you know, we can try to, you know, understand it, but it also gets really confusing because of course there's, you know, it does feel very personal. It's like, yeah, this is definitely who I am. And that's absolutely right. I mean, it's really the definition of this is who and what I am. So when we talk about non-self, it's really a very different shift of paradigm, of perspective, of orientation, of how we're actually, all this fundamental assumptions turn on their heads. And so trying to look at the self from this perspective of a self, from the normal paradigm, it's just like this, you know, it doesn't make much sense. Because it's like we look for the self, and we're trying to see the self, but the self is really what's doing all the looking. And the self is doing, it's like I'm feeling blamed, I'm feeling judged, I'm judging myself, there's all this stuff. Yeah, of course the self is all right there. And so I don't know if it's how possible it is actually to be able to step back in the midst of that, to notice that there's a self arising, unless you've had tastes of that non-self. Because like, yeah, so when you, and it's actually like Ajahn Buddhadasa would talk about these everyday nibbanas, everyday, that cooling of that thirst of that selfing. Those actually happen all the time. It's just we don't notice them because they're not interesting. They're not distressing. They're not exciting. They're just like, oh, there's a bird, you know, and we're not really making a big thing about it. We're not forming in a lot of relationship to it. We just, that sound just passes through. We kind of miss it. We don't really see it. So his teaching on that, there's a nice article he wrote about that, is to notice, start to notice those quiet, natural points in your life, you know, in the day. Time we were naturally more quiet and start to bring more interest to that. Because I think our assumption is that that's just kind of this little lull between what's really happening, which is all our, you know, churning stuff. But maybe it's the other way around. Maybe that's the actual natural state and that those churnings are what arises. Right? So the more we kind of get a sense of that, you know, then we can start to maybe even call it forth in the midst of it and start to actually get a sense of, wow, I really feel intact here. And there is that, you're able to step back and by knowing the absence of self, you can step back and see the self more clearly, how that's forming. Another way to work with it is just to simply go directly into it and say, okay, I'm having this, all this emotion, all these thoughts. Where is that I? You know, can I actually find exactly where it is? Is it tangible like this clock? Can I actually touch it? Can I say, oh, here's the seat of I? You know, we can maybe feel the seat of the emotion, the seat of the sensation. But the actual perspective of where that I actually is, because we really take it as being something super solid, right? Something we can actually, here I am, this is what I am. But when we actually start to look at that, you know, actually seek it, it becomes much more elusive. Because it's really, the reason is because it's something that we've kind of manufactured out of that stillness. So yeah, I think it's in the midst of it, you know, in the midst of it, it's like the self trying to find the self. It's much harder. I think it's in those states, it's much better to kind of say, okay, let me bring as much compassion to the self that I can. Yeah. Let me really feel this pain. Let me feel how I might be, you know, projecting on other people, how I'm, you know, reinterpreting, you know, all those things. Just bring a whole lot of compassion to it. And that starts to quiet things down, give more space to it. Yeah, because the non-nata, the non-self teaching, sometimes in that way it gets too confusing and it's not as helpful.
Yeah,
that's right. All right, thank you, Cheryl. All right, so Ruth, would you like to go?
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I'm struggling with blame and feeling blamed and then feeling angry for being blamed and really seeing, you know, my sense of self kind of form around it and wanting to stay true to what I value and stay kind and not do harm. And yet I also like, I wonder about the need for authenticity or honesty sometimes, like, and I don't really see any way, any good path for sort of defending myself or going to that in this situation. And yet I also worry that if I'm not speaking my truth, then resentment builds. So I'm really wanting to kind of release my formation of I and my triggering around being blamed without doing anything. And yet I worry that it'll harbor like a deeper resentment that'll just cause me to be triggered more again. And so I'm struggling with like, when do you need to resolve it somehow? Or can you really just release it long term if you just keep working with it over and over again and you never need to express yourself? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yes, that makes sense. Yeah, and you've kind of touched upon this important, sometimes this distortion that comes around equanimity, that we think, okay, I'm supposed to be that kind of not affected by life. That's my idea of equanimity. And so then I kind of make myself be that way when I'm really not. And so then there's that resentment that builds up. There's that charge that builds up because we're not really fully acknowledging or honoring what's here. I think there's a saying in Zen that the way to Nibbana is through samsara. You know, is through the pain, is through the muck, through all the difficulty. And so, and certainly, you know, especially with when you're feeling blamed and you're feeling criticized, the ways when it's been felt very personal and I've really felt triggered by that, I have to spend a lot of time just feeling that very personal nature of it. You know, and because so often we just impose this dharmic idea that I'm supposed to not feel that, and I feel bad about feeling that, and then suddenly we've tied, you know, a difficult thing, we've made it even worse because we have this a more sophisticated way to judge ourselves, you know. And I think sometimes it's better just to be very human, to be fully human in this, and you know, just go into the mess of it. And so often, you know, I might, you know, find someone like my wife, go for, you know, she's had to listen to me so much when I'm processing stuff, talking about things, you know, or you can maybe have a dear friend or whoever you might have, or even if you don't, you know, have that, or if you do, you might also write it out. Because sometimes we think things through so much, but actually to put it down on paper, I think physically writing too is as powerful. To write it out. This is what I'm feeling. This is what I'm believing. This is what I think is true. All those things help to kind of clarify the muck, the mess, the you know, the pain around that. You know, like how I just can't believe they're judging me. They really don't see me. There's all these things they don't see. And don't judge any of that. Let that be voiced. And by, you know, being paid, and this might, you know, depending on how deep it goes and how hard it is, it might take months or long, sometimes years to kind of work with it in deeper ways. But then there's a point where you start to realize, as I've done this myself, I'm taking, you know, speaking from my own experience, there's this shifting point where I stop always blaming the person, you know, doing the counter blame or defending myself, to actually see a different perspective. There's that shift. It's like, oh, I can see why they might blame me. I can see why I wasn't so skillful. You actually take it in, you know, not in a way that reinforces that self-hatred, but it's like, oh yeah, maybe I wasn't up to my best at that point. Yeah. And so there's a shift of perspective. So like with Cheryl, is talking about that shift, that paradigm shift from this perspective of self to the perspective of non-self. There's a small way this happens when we have that, okay, I really am fortified around this position, and that position dissolves just through seeing it, through really acknowledging it. That loosens that foundation of self in that, at least around that particular arena. When you can see another person's point of view so clearly. And so what we're trying to really do is learn to kind of clear up our projections, our own hurts, because so often, you know, those situations in our life become placeholders for something much older, much more archaic, much more tender, and much harder to resolve. You know, we're trying to resolve that in this present moment relationship. But as we really feel that, realize it's not fair for me to ask this other person to fix my childhood, you know, losses, my childhood abuse, my childhood neglect, whatever it might be. And then you start to become more, so there's this maturation that starts to happen. And that, you know, and so you can see how there's this really working with it. You know, fundamental is acknowledging what's here very deeply, meeting with as much wisdom and compassion. And then from that point, then the skillful action arises. And maybe it is having a conversation with that person, you know, seeing that when you said this, you know, I felt hurt. And depending on the relationship, you might be able to say that more sooner than later in that process. But it's this idea that we shouldn't have that arise. If it's arising, we have to really acknowledge that and meet that. And actually going in, seeing, okay, this is really an opportunity to understand myself really deeply. And as we understand myself more and more deeply, that starts to really show you the illusion of self in a very personal, very direct way. And then maybe another time it arises, oh, there's that charge, but it doesn't have much current behind it. Right. How does that sound, Ruth? Is that helpful, I hope?
Yeah, feel like I should be having gratitude to her for leading me to this investigation. Thank you.
Yeah, when you feel that gratitude, then you know you've really shifted around it. That was like talking with Sean, the first question around welcoming pain. Like you don't welcome the pain, but you welcome the lessons from that pain. And that's that gratitude, like, well, thank you for really showing me this part of me that's so tender. And then you know the practice, yeah, this confidence, whatever arises, I can meet it. I can turn toward it.
That's really beautiful. Thanks, Tim. Super helpful.
You're very welcome, Ruth. Thank you for sharing that. All right. So anyone here in the room like to share anything else? Yeah, come on up. If you don't mind, you can grab the mic.
So thinking about these different worldly winds, I started thinking about loss aversion in economics, I guess, where, you know, it hurts more to lose $100 than it feels good to gain $100. Mm-hmm. And it sort of feels like there's a million ways to suffer, and there's like, you know, only kind of a few ways to experience pleasure or happiness, and the degree to which you can suffer feels kind of like infinite, whereas the cap on pleasure and happiness and the, you know, these positive ones feels like there's more of a ceiling. And so as much as I'm trying to think of them as like an equal yin yang, I'm having trouble with this idea that while they both come and go, they're both temporary, but it feels like the negative ones, there's a lot more of them, and they can be a lot worse than the good ones can be good. So I was just curious what your thoughts were on that.
Yes, thank you. And I think it's even worse than what you say, because even the pleasurable things don't last. Right? you know, so like even that, so like we have pain on the discomfort and we have pain when the good things leave. So what are we to do? You know, what are we to do? And so, and that's really, you know, the Buddha's first noble truth. It's that there is dukkha, there is this suffering. And so I think what you're seeing is more and more clearly how deep that suffering goes. As you said, there's just thousands, you know, thousands and thousands of ways of suffering. And that's true because there's manifest way, so many minute ways we experience it. There's really one fundamental way that we're suffering. And that's what the Buddha taught. It's like, okay, you know, here we are. You know, I remember this sutta early in the early teachings before he became the Buddha. He realized, you know, here I am seeking after, you know, pleasure and pain and, you know, but it's always in flux. It's always impermanent. And what's worse is that I'm actually impermanent too, that I'm always in flux. So there's these two things always changing. That doesn't make any sense. So it must be some other way, some other thing. And that's what started him off on his journey, his 6-year journey of practice, of understand, of trying to seek what is not changing. Now, when you start to get more of a sense of that, that's that paradigm shift that we're talking about with Cheryl's question. It's a fundamental shift that from our normal, all these dualities, there's always going to be pain with that. And the pleasure is going to be fleeting, you know. But there is something that is outside of this, of pleasure and pain and gain and loss. That's what the Buddha discovered. That's what the Dharma practice at the heart is trying to understand and see. What is outside of these two? What is outside? And then we can't see it through our our normal rational mind, because that mind is really embedded in the problem in itself. And so, as we've talked about, we see it in the we see, you know, the intensity of it, we lose, it's so hard to see that. But start to notice in the subtle ways that maybe you're just sitting and you're just feeling there's a sense of contentment, like there's not much that needs to be changed. You're just feeling this one breath is enough. You know, maybe after meditation, you just go out and you feel this sense of accessibility to nature or to meeting a loved one or even just relating to yourself. There's a way that you're able to perceive and connect with it that's not usually connected in the same way of wanting and not wanting. It's not part of these eight dualities. It's outside of that. So in some ways, what you're describing is in some ways the first step, is to really see deeply the nature of dukkha. And to understand the second noble truth is to understand why that arises. The third noble truth is to see the cessation of that. So it's a disillusionment, you know, because so much of our lives we don't realize what you're seeing. We keep chasing after that pleasure and trying to avoid the pain, even though we don't step back and see how much suffering there really is in this whole field of life. So remember, the Buddha taught dukkha and the end of dukkha. All right. How's that sound, Clay? I don't know if it's kind of went full all the deepness there very quickly. Yeah, but this is really wise to see that's the suffering, how deep it is, how much it runs, and how much we chase after the ease of that. And that's the essence of why we practice the Dharma. All right, so we're almost at the end of our evening, so thank you all for your questions. And I just have one quick announcement. So one area of dukkha, one area of suffering we experience in our culture is around racism, is around the idea of race, that sense of otherness that we create. And it's so important for us to deepen around that, to understand it more and more clearly. Especially as white people, to start to see, you know, our privilege, to see our unconscious racism. And so at Sims, we're beginning that work in more and more ways. And this last year, there's a group of about 28 of us who went through a year-long process, and we're going to start a new one coming up probably in February. And this one is, there's no cost to it. It's groups of like three or four people, a chance to really engage and talk, you know, once a month, kind of do some readings and really articulate your understanding around it. And it's hard work, it's difficult work, but it's also really essential work if we are serious about healing, you know, the pain that so many of our people of color experience. So I encourage you to consider doing it. It's, you know, I did it myself last year, and it was a very rich experience to be with the same people over this whole year process. So to do that, you can contact Iris at engagement@seattleinsight.org. And Kathy, hopefully you have that to post. So engagement@seattleinsight.org. And those here in the room, you can also go to that email, or I can show it to you. And so we'll have some small groups that will form. Again, there's no cost. It's a well-designed program. And it's mostly focused toward white people waking up to their own unconscious racism. And it's a profound way to start to bring healing around this.